This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is the new On Point. Conspiracy theorist and conservative talk show host Alex Jones was sidelined earlier this month, at least in part, by the big tech giants, first Apple, and then Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Spotify. Some call this unfair censorship, others say good riddance. This is new territory. In our digital age, where do we draw the line? And how do we draw the line? And who is this we anyway? This hour, On Point. Alex Jones, social media, and free speech. You can join us on air or online. We're going to explore all this with some folks who have thought about this hard. But I'd love to hear your take on Alex Jones, on his role in our boisterous food fight of a national conversation, and on what, if anything, we should do in response. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's start by setting the stakes here. You know, Alex Jones is outraged. He is often outraged, but this time he's outraged by what he says is being purged. He appeared on the conservative talk show host Michael Savage's radio program, and he talked about how much he objected and why he objected to the removal of much of his content from the big social media sites.
Total deplatforming on hundreds of podcast platforms, YouTube, Facebook, so many other platforms, Apple, iTunes, where we had tens of millions of subscribers just on iTunes, 2.5 million subscribers on YouTube. All of it is completely deleted. They don't even put strikes against the account. They don't claim we violated the rules. There is a night of long knives or Kristallnacht, a total purge of me.
Getting beyond the invocation of Kristallnacht, a reference to the outset of the Holocaust, Jones is saying, you know, he's being wiped off these social media platforms. And we'll hear over the course of this hour a little bit more about what some of these social media giants specifically did and how they come to those circumstances. But it's worth also listening to some of the content that people find most objectionable about Jones, even if it wasn't the content that necessarily got him bounced from some of the platforms themselves. Here was Jones in 2014 claiming that the 2012 Sandy Hook school shooting in Connecticut, which took the lives of 20 children, was a hoax.
People just instinctively know that there's a lot of fraud going on. But it took me about a year with Sandy Hook to come to grips with the fact that the whole thing was fake. I mean, even I couldn't believe it. I knew they jumped on it, used the crisis, hyped it up. But then I did deep research, and my gosh, it just pretty much didn't happen.
Alex Jones claiming it just pretty much didn't happen, and of course, horribly, it did. Joining me now from Houston, Texas, is Bill Ogden. He's a partner at Farah & Ball LLP law firm in Houston, Texas. He represents parents of two children who were killed in the Sandy Hook school shooting and a family suing over claims Jones made about the Parkland school shooting in Florida earlier this year. They are suing Alex Jones in separate cases for defamation. Bill Ogden, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Can you please explain for our listeners and our audiences a little bit about the claim that you are making? We live in a country that, not uniquely, but you know, has a strong tradition of free speech and cling to that from the top offices on down, even if sometimes it's done in the contradiction of it. Can you explain to me what your cases are specifically against Alex Jones and what your clients find so objectionable?
Sure. So I represent the parents of two young children that were sadly killed at Sandy Hook. And I also represent an individual who was identified as the Parkland, Florida shooter, the high school shooting that happened in Florida. And it ended up the person they identified was a young man in Massachusetts who's never been to Florida. So the lawsuits are defamation lawsuits. And you mentioned earlier that we have a long history of free speech in this country, and that is true, but we don't have the absolute right of freedom of speech. The law goes back decades, if not maybe a century or two, saying what you can and can't say, and something like you can't yell fire in a movie theater and cause, or you can't incite a riot. It's restrictions like that. Mm-hmm. And so we have what we call protected speech, and then we have non-protected speech, which would fall into defamation. And defamation, you can't make up a false statement about somebody and cause them injury without facing consequences. And so these lawsuits, specifically for the Sandy Hook parents, are based on false statements that Mr. Jones has made that has caused my client's injury.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, people say, well, you know, it's hard to point to harm being caused by you know, incendiary speech at times. Obviously, Pizzagate, another controversy in which Alex Jones was involved, did end up with a person driving up from North Carolina and shooting up, thankfully without injury, but shooting up or significant injury, but shooting up a pizza parlor in Northwest Washington, D.C. What was the harm that your clients say was done? How have their lives been affected by this?
Sure. First of all, when we say harm, that's an interesting term that we use. It's almost a term of art in the legal world, which is harm, injuries, or damages. What are your harm and injuries? And typically a jury decides that. But in our cases, specifically if you want hard evidence of damages, Lenny Posner and Veronique De La Rosa were the parents of one sad child and that passed away. They had to move 7 times since then because they've been harassed.
They've had to move where they live 7 times.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
They've moved houses 7 times because of the harassment. There's also a woman named Lucy Richards who lived down in Florida. And she harassed Mr. Posner so much that she ended up actually getting convicted in federal court of stalking him and giving him death threats and was sentenced to 6 months in prison. And also one of the terms coming out was that she wasn't allowed to access InfoWars ever again. So just like in Pizzagate that you cited where somebody went in and shot up something, these are people's lives are now in danger because of the speech that's inciting this type of behavior.
And so what are you seeking as the remedy here, briefly, sir?
So our society is unique in that the only way we say I'm sorry is in a courtroom, and that's a jury awarding monetary damages. And so we're going to give this case to a Travis County jury in Austin, Texas, which is where Mr. Jones lives and where InfoWars is based out of, and we're going to let them decide what the actual number is. But they're going to have things like pain and suffering, mental anguish, things like that, all of my clients have sought some sort of therapy and mental health therapy to help them with some of the things that they're having to deal with in life. Because when you look at the Sandy Hook parents, they had to bury a child, and I think that's the worst thing that a parent would ever have to do.
Yes.
And instead of just trying to cope with that and move on, for 4.5 years, they've been harassed and reminded about the worst day of their life by Mr. Jones. And it got to the point where it damaged them. And so we're going to let a Travis County jury decide how much damage that was.
Bill Ogden, thank you for sharing their story with us. Bill is a lawyer. He represents families who are suing Alex Jones for defamation. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks, David.
It's worth pointing out that Jones' attorney, Mark Enoch, told the judge presiding in the case, Jones, the political commentator, and what he says is broadcast is protected political speech. He says it's rhetorical hyperbole, even though Jones himself has said in the video played in the court, quote, "We're so real, they say we're fake." I'd like to take on a call now from Milford, Connecticut. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, buddy. How are you?
Okay. You know, I believe in freedom of speech, but any speech, in particular inciting violence, is not freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
It's breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
You're inciting violence. You could be arrested for it. And that's my thought on most of these conspiracy people. And, you know, like Donald Trump said, hey, somebody punched that guy in the face, and they did. And
you're saying basically
violence.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
No, that's inciting violence. That's my point.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that, John. And that is one of those lines where, in fact, not all speech is fully protected in this country. I'd like to bring in this moment now a woman who knows something about the law. She is an assistant professor of law at St. John's University in Queens, New York. Kate Klonick studies closely the intersection of law and technology. Her recent article in the Harvard Law Review is called "The New Governors: The People, Rules, and Processes Governing Online Speech." Kate, thanks so much for being here today on Point.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
I'd just like you to sketch for we've only got a minute or so left, but sketch in this segment, but sketch for me a little bit the issues that you think are raised with the ways in which, for example, people sympathetic to the families that Bill Ogden represents might be thinking about this issue and related ones in terms of how social media giants regulate the speech that happens on their platforms.
Yeah, well, I think that what we're kind of, I want to kind of delineate between the lawsuit and the attorney that you just had on and what's going on with his case and all of the other cases against Alex Jones and what these platforms are doing. And these platforms are private entities that can completely, that are outside the bounds of the First Amendment and can make choices about what they decide to keep up and take down. Totally based on how they think they want their platform to be and what they want their community to look like. And so they're completely within their rights to take down Alex Jones. The more interesting question is kind of whether or not we want a world in which someone like Alex Jones, who we might not agree with and might think is abhorrent, but is basically totally quelled or completely unable to get his message out online because there is kind of a herding of all of these platforms to take him down, or there's a monopoly over some of these platform publication outlets, and so taking him down or banning him makes it so people like him can never speak again. I mean, some people might be totally fine with that, but there are obvious problems.
This is the stakes. I want to mention a commenter from our website. Mushroom Hunter writes, "I suppose we do have to protect Alex Jones's First Amendment rights if we want to be honest with ourselves. That said, private companies can decide for themselves if they want his content on their media." Wynn Farmer, a listener on Facebook, writes, "Despicable as Jones is, banning him will just make his supporters more hysterical than they already all are. They'll flock to his site, InfoWars." So here we are. We're discussing free speech in the age of social media. You can join our conversation. What kind of power to control content do you think Facebook, Apple, Google, and Twitter should have? Did they do the right thing with Alex Jones? Should they be more hands-off? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. States and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the recent controversy over pulling down Alex Jones's content from many of the big social media platforms. You can join the conversation. Let's think about that line when it comes to internet and free speech. Follow us on Twitter and find us on the Facebooks at On Point Radio. I'd like to go to a call from Rome, Georgia. Russell, thanks for listening. What do you think of all this?
I just think that it's kind of a weird situation where you have a big tech company sort of curating what's okay for you to listen to and not okay for you to listen to. I'm probably in a major minority where I love to listen to NPR every day and I listen to Alex every day. And now I can't get on iTunes and get his podcast anymore. My market doesn't carry him, so that's the only way for me to listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of really bothers me that Apple is telling me what I can and cannot listen to.
So let me ask you a question, Russell. Would you see it any differently? Let's say you went to Barnes & Noble and they decided to carry some books and not others. Do you see a difference there?
No, I don't think any company while they do have that right, I feel like the social media platforms and iTunes and all are sort of in a different category, because that's a huge revenue stream for InfoWars. That's how it's not the same as free speech just in general.
Mm-hmm.
It also hurts them monetarily really bad, and it's just, I find it sort of setting a very dangerous precedent, because what comes next?
Well,
first it's Alex, and what else is not going to be acceptable for us to listen to, and why are they the ones telling us we can't listen to whatever it is they deem unlistenable to?
Well, Russell from Rome, Georgia, thank you. A uniter, not a divider, uniting us, and Alex Jones, and thanking you for listening. With me here on in studio is Kate Klonick. She's law professor at St. John's University. She thinks hard about technology and the law. And I'd like to bring in another voice to this conversation. From Pasadena, California, we've got Adrian Chen in studio. He's a writer who's covered technology and internet culture for a variety of outlets. I've read him for many years in places including The New Yorker, The New York Times, Wired Magazine, and The Late Gawker. Well, Adrian, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, Adrian, let's talk a little bit about this. How should we think about the role? I think this is sort of implied in what we just heard from Russell about the role that these social media platforms play. They are private companies, as Kate has written. They have their own First Amendment rights to decide what they do and don't post. But, you know, I think over half the nation has a Facebook account. Many, many tens of millions of Americans rely on Twitter. How are we to think about these guys and their ability to have discretion over what we see and hear and watch?
Well, yeah, I think the size and the scope of it that you pointed out does make it a little different than something like a Barnes & Noble, where people are really using these things now as a public square. This is where so much of the discourse of that goes into politics and also our lives happens. And so it's really a sort of privately controlled sort of semi-public space. And that's something that is very new about the platforms versus old media.
So, you know, from your reporting, what is your sense of how seriously they're taking this? The role that they have, the ability that they have, how seriously are they approaching this issue?
I mean, I think that they are taking it very seriously, definitely more than they have been. I think the problem is that the scope and the complexity of these systems has grown so large that I really question their ability to actually control anything or to make any conscious decisions about how things will unfold in the future. And you saw this, for example, with the Cambridge Analytica scandal, where even they couldn't really predict what would happen to their users' data until it had already fallen in the hands of this private company, you know, millions of them years later.
I mean, the amazing thing is right there, you're talking about, you know, controversy and scandal one upon another there. You're talking about Cambridge Analytica, the use of private data. You're also talking about a company that was at the heart of, you know, what turned out to be the exploitation of people's readerships to convey false news narratives and sort of hoax stories to influence the 2016 elections, right? So, you know, there's the ability of Facebook and Twitter, which they are grappling with, and YouTube and Google and others, to figure out how to deal with this seems to be layered in a variety of ways. Kate, you really did such a thoughtful treatment in your Law Review article, I've got to say, of how they approach this. But you ended up, at least from my reading, you emerged with a pretty healthy respect for their seriousness of purpose.
Yeah, I think that you asked before whether you think they're taking it seriously. And my research says that they're definitely taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're working really, really hard to solve these problems and to kind of figure out how they want to respond to them. I think that one of the dangers that you brought up in like the intro to this show, and is something really interesting to think about, is you said, like, what do we want them to do? And your caller who just called in was like bothered by the fact that tech companies get to control his access to information about things that he, you know, that he just doesn't feel like that's right. He should have access to this information. And I guess there's two questions there. And one that you brought up is, who is the we anyway? So like you said, which I think is a really great problem, because these are global transnational companies. And so the standards that they're setting are enforced globally. And that's kind of a very interesting problem, because the way that they set their standards for speech in the U.S. is very different from the norms and the standards that people want set in the EU or in Africa or in India. And so these are just kind of – this is some of the stuff that they're struggling with.
You know, I think that's very interesting. You talk about the way in which there are global standards, and you talk about the way in which, in some ways, these are transnational companies that operate on their own, and yet they've got to deal with laws here and abroad. You know, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook, has addressed this. He's talked about he testified in front of Congress saying he, you know, doesn't want to think about what he's doing as censoring speech, but to think about types of content like terrorism that sort of we can all agree we don't want to have on the service. So, you know, the question of decapitations, the question of torture and things like that. And then, you know, he stirred controversy last month. He was speaking with Recode, the digital news site, and said that he didn't believe Facebook should be removing content promoting even such controversial things as Holocaust denial from its platform. Here's what Zuckerberg said to Kara Swisher on her podcast.
So I'm Jewish, and there's a set of people who deny that the Holocaust happened,
yes,
right? I find that deeply offensive. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I don't believe that our platform should take that down, because I think that there are things that different people get wrong. I don't think that they're intentionally getting it wrong, but I think that
in case of the Holocaust deniers, they might be. But go ahead.
In case of the Holocaust deniers, they might be. In fact, they are. Zuckerberg, after a lot of public criticism, went on to say he doesn't believe Facebook should censor posts just to, because they're inaccurate, unless they're attempting to specifically incite violence. And then he kind of had to address the question of Holocaust deniers generally. The interesting thing to me in that, Kate Klonick, is, of course, in Europe, there are certain rules about hate speech and certain rules about what you can say, I think, in Germany about the Holocaust that are much more restrictive than what we would allow in this country in terms of just free speech issues. Let me put it this way. How accurate would you say what Zuckerberg and other digital media platform executives say about what they're doing? How accurate is that in terms of meshing with what they actually do? Is there a principle behind it, or are they sort of improvising as they go along?
Yeah, no, I think that this point that they're not that Zuckerberg is not going in Kara Swisher and improvising. I think he's been prepped very well for those interviews and for going into Congress.
Less improvising in interviews and more a question of whether the people who work for him are improvising in the choices they're making. Or it's clear cut and they know what they're doing as they go along.
Yeah, no, I mean, here's the thing. I think that there was a period in which these rules developed in like 2008 to 2013, and they kind of made a very procedurally based set of rules that were really just meant to not get everything right all of the time, but to create something that got things right most of the time in terms of being able to take down and keep up content. One of the things that I hear when I listen to that excerpt from Kara Swisher with Zuckerberg is I hear him talking about it in a way that's like, well, listen, the Holocaust is a really easy thing to decide whether or not the people who are talking about that are right or wrong. We all know that that's not something that's true. But if Facebook gets in the business of making that type of decision on all types of content globally, conversations that are like range in scope from, you know, whether or not someone else pulled someone's hair and then it go like in a middle school dance or something, and then it goes online and someone gets upset and there's bullying and all types of, if you start becoming the adjudicator of truth, that's just an enormous responsibility for Facebook to be doing. And I think that like Zuckerberg is looking down the road and seeing all of the incredibly hard and impossible decisions that might have to be made if Facebook gets in that business.
Right. There's this tension between and you identified certain legal protections that were built in law between being a publisher and being a platform. That is, you know, in the old days, we would have thought of as a distinction between the New York Times deciding what you publish or ABC News and being AT&T and allowing people to talk on the phone. Right. And this is a very middle space. They at once are a publisher and they aren't. They at once are a platform and they aren't. And when they start making decisions, it pushes them more into a journalistic or publisher role. And yet there is some protection under the law to say, look, you're going to be able to take down child pornography, which is not defended under law. You can take down incitement against violence, which is not protected under the law. And as private companies, they can do what they want. But it seems to me they're not sure what they want to do. And it also seems to me as though it's not entirely sure why they're not sure what they want to do. What do you think is motivating them? What do you think from your research, Kate, do you think is the basis of the decisions they're making?
Yeah, from what I've talked to them, and I think that this is genuine because it's something I've heard over and over and over again from people who are both there now and who have left. What they're really trying to do, at least at Facebook, is to balance user safety and user experience against users' ability to speak and users' ability to post content and share content. And that's, you know, that's a tremendously hard thing to balance. One person might feel like they're being bullied, and another might think that they're speaking out, speaking truth to power. These types of distinctions are difficult for judges, right? This is not easy stuff, and I think that that's kind of the biggest thing that everyone is coming to the realization really very slowly with the Alex Jones thing, which is kind of like, this is a hard question. He's pretty offensive, and it still feels dangerous and powerful because, as Adrian pointed out, these are not Barnes and Noble; these are kind of access points to that are much greater. And by controlling these kind of access points to knowledge, you really do get into questions of what happens if you want to have counter speech to counter the Holocaust deniers. That's also important, but you would have to block that as well. I don't know. There's a whole bunch of problems that you run into when you start to make rules for this stuff, but they're being pushed in this direction. So this is, I guess, where they have to go.
Adrian Chen, you've written a lot about different aspects of how some of these social media outlets are used and how they are run. There are concerns. The reason that Mark Zuckerberg and other social media chiefs were called to the Hill is that there's great fear of regulation, of the government getting involved and saying how they can do what they can do, as occurs to a much greater degree in the European Union. And there's, also concern about turning off users. What, how sincere do you find the statements from Zuckerberg, from his counterparts at other social media platforms, which say that they say we have strikes. We can't show you exactly the algorithm we use to decide to take people down or to leave people up. But believe us, we're taking this pretty seriously.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do think that they are being sincere, that they have a really obvious desire to fix this problem, make it go away. But I think the focus on the sort of personalization of Mark Zuckerberg, is he serious or not? Can he is he making the right moves? What kind of responsibility does he has? Obscures the larger issue, which is that we have turned over so much of our public debate, mm-hmm. of our personal lives, to a handful of privately owned companies in Silicon Valley. And that is a bigger problem and a more fundamental problem that doesn't really depend on the people in charge. And the philosopher L.M. Sakasas actually had a really great essay that I would recommend everyone check out, where he argued that the focus on the sort of misinformation or propaganda or censorship, all the bad aspects of social media we've seen now, is sort of obscuring the fundamental fact that we have turned over a lot of control and a lot of autonomy to these sort of impersonal, abstract, incredibly complex systems that even their own creators don't seem to be able to control. And he cites this essay by the critic Lewis Mumford, who talks about this the magnificent bribe involved in technology, which is that technology will grant us all of these amazing things, all of these powers, all of these abilities, and all we have to do is not ask for anything more than they can give us, and not to to turn away anything that they do give us. And that sort of reduces all of our life, as more and more of our life happens over these platforms, into what Facebook, Google, Apple can process and sell to us. And I think that that is a huge problem that is much bigger than whether or not some crank gets banned off of Facebook.
I want to pivot a little bit, very briefly before the break, take a call from York, Maine. Ali, I believe it is. You're on the air. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I just want to say that if his name was like Imam Jones and somebody went out and shot up a pizzeria, I feel like that they would have much worse repercussions than what it is now. Mm-hmm. If it was like a Muslim cleric, you know.
Mm-hmm. You'd be seen as an external terrorist threat rather than a possibly incendiary comment. Ali, thank you for your call. Adrian, we've only got about 45 seconds left for this, but do you think that our response to these things are tempered by our politics, by demographics, by the question of our fear of Islamist terrorism?
Our response to what? Sorry.
Sorry. Just do you think there's a difference if it involves a white outrageous speaker versus a people of color, or particularly people that we could make connections to terrorism abroad to?
Well, definitely. I mean, given the history of Islamophobia and the war on terror, obviously a Muslim or a brown person making that kind of threat will generate a lot more reaction and concern than a white guy.
Well, Adrian Chen, stick around. Kate Klonick is a law professor at St. John's University in Queens, New York. It was great to have you on today. Appreciate your joining On Point.
Thanks for having me.
We're discussing free speech and social media. You can join the conversation. Where would you draw the line? What obligations do you think Facebook and Twitter and all the rest have to police what you see? How much do you trust them to make those choices? We hope you'll make the choice to join us. Stick around. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is the new On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, y'all. I'm Sam Sanders. I host an NPR show called It's Been a Minute. Every Friday on the show, I talk out the week of news. Because sometimes the best way to process everything going on right now is through good conversation. Download the show, and we'll process everything together.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about social media and the internet and the controversy over Alex Jones and the broader questions. You can join our conversation. What are you seeing online that gives you pause? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With us is Adrian Chen. He's a journalist who writes about technology and culture. And now I'm being joined by Jeff Jarvis from, of all places, Buenos Aires. Jeff writes an influential media blog at buzzmachine.com, and he's professor and director of the Tau Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. He's also author of several books about the way the digital age works, including one called Public Parts, How Sharing in the Digital Age Improves the Way We Work and Live. Jeff, I think I got all that right. Good to have you on the show.
And congratulations, David, for taking helm of On Point Friday.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it. Jeff, talk to me a little bit. You've written for The Atlantic and for your blog in recent weeks about this very issue. And while it seems to me you're sympathetic to those who thought that it was time to purge Jones one way or another from major social media platforms, you warn about a moral panic. Tell me what you're concerned about when it comes to people and information and the social media platforms.
I'm concerned that we in media, we in journalism, are painting a picture of the social world that's not accurate. When people say, oh my God, social media is falling apart, it's ruining the world, I ask them to please look at their Facebook feed and even their Twitter feed and show me the den of Nazis there. It's not there. What we're talking about is a small number of well-trained and provisioned manipulators, whether those are economically motivated, that's spammers, or psychologically motivated, that's trolls, or politically motivated, these days that's Russians, who are manipulating the platforms. And sometimes we in media do their bidding by reporting not just their methodology, but also their messages. And I'm concerned that when the narrative is that, oh my God, the sky is falling, everything's falling apart, we're going to end up with regulation that's going to have a far greater impact on free speech and the freedom of the net.
So you're concerned that we're misunderstanding the way in which it actually works, the way in which conversation works online. How do you feel about the role of response? What responsibility, if any, you think that these platforms have to moderate, to curate, or, in the words of others, censor what goes online?
Freedom of speech is the freedom not only to say something, but the freedom not to be forced to say something. Mm-hmm. And the platforms are private companies. They are not the totality of the Internet. And I think that, you know, I used to be, David, pretty much a dogmatist about the openness of the net. But I had to learn and see that pure openness breeds trolls and breeds manipulation. It's a weakness in the system. So I do think the platforms have to compensate for this manipulation. I think it's their right and their responsibility to do so. Part of the problem here is that when it came to InfoWars and Alex Jones, the platforms, not unlike lawmakers, want a set of rules to say, this is why something's on the right side or the wrong side of the line. In your earlier interview, quote from Zuckerberg with Kara Swisher, he put the line at inciting imminent violence. Mm-hmm. So InfoWars was on the apparently right side of that line until a huge uproar occurred. And I realized then that the way we as society negotiate our norms and our standards is anecdotally. People yelled and screamed and said, whatever your rules are, if it allows InfoWars in, those rules aren't working. So anecdotally, InfoWars is gone. And now the platforms have a very hard job of trying to back up and come up with a rule set that keeps InfoWars out but keeps most other speech in.
You know, the amazing thing is Alex Jones, when he was complaining in a clip that we played at the top of the hour of how he had basically been banned for the web, banned from social media, I wanted to find his response. I Googled him, found his Twitter feed. It linked to a Periscope account that he had, and he posted his objections there. So there were three accounts that he was still on in, you know, very mainstream social media platforms, even as he was claiming he was banned from the web. Twitter then did take some actions. You know, there's been this claim from conservatives, Senator Ted Cruz, among others, that conservatives are being unfairly, you know, essentially purged from social media platforms, claims of what's called shadow banning from various personalities. A lot of these claims don't seem to bear out under close scrutiny, but there is the belief that there's an unfairness there. You know, President Trump himself on Tuesday, after a day of dreadful news, that day that included Paul Manafort's conviction, his former campaign manager, his former lawyer, Michael Cohen's guilty plea, President Trump talked about censorship, free speech at a West Virginia campaign rally.
You can't have censorship. You can't pick one person and say, well, we don't like what he's been saying, he's out. So we'll live with fake news. I mean, I hate to say it, but we have no choice because that's by far the better alternative. You can't have people saying censorship, because you know what? It can turn around. It can be them next. It can be them next.
Among those seeking to be very responsive to claims of unfairness towards conservatives is Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey. He sat down with a number of figures in the media over recent days to try to address a number of concerns. But that among them, he went on Sean Hannity's radio show and he said, you know, he wanted to reach Hannity's listeners to make sure they understood where he was coming from. He also sat down with CNN's Brian Stelter this past weekend and he addressed the question of whether his social media company at Twitter has a bias.
We need to constantly show that we are not adding our own bias, which I fully admit is more left-leaning. And I think it's important to articulate our bias and to share it with people so that people understand us. But we need to remove all bias from how we act and our policies and our enforcement.
We have a call now from Richmond, Virginia. Lisa, I understand you have concerns along these lines. Thanks for listening. Tell me what your thoughts are about all this.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering if you think Maxine Waters should be sued for inciting violence when she makes comments. And frankly, the mainstream media is constantly attacking Trump.
Can I think
the constant her comment should is if that's inciting violence and she should be sued.
Well, I want to be very clear for listeners here, Lisa, and thank you for your call. You know, there's a difference perhaps between a congresswoman and a public radio person or and a radio personality like Alex Jones. But also, you know, the incident that I'm aware of with Maxine Waters, she said people should be up in their faces, I guess, in a reference. This was a time after which the Homeland Security Secretary had been confronted by people who were objecting to her stances separating parents from children who were in this country, perhaps without legal status. But I did not – I'm not aware of any point at which Maxine Waters advocated violence. So I just want to be clear about that because we need to keep faith with our listeners. If I find it to be different, I'll make sure to share that with our audience as well. But certainly, Adrian Chen, a lot of objection on the political right to the idea that people in Silicon Valley are going to be able to pick and choose not only how often you see things in your newsfeed or in what relationship you see things in newsfeed, but maybe that you see them in your feeds at all.
Yeah, and you know, this is a long-standing criticism of conservatives, not just of social media and Facebook, but of, you know, previous gatekeepers and institutions like newspapers or the FCC. And they've always used this sort of claim of neutrality to bat in against and to try to reveal, you know, what they claim is hidden bias. And I think what we're seeing now is actually their attacks are a lot more resonant and a lot more effective because of the amount of power that Facebook, Google, Apple have, and because of how opaque this is governed. You know, all of what we see on our Facebook feeds is governed by algorithms that we don't know what's going on. A lot of the content is moderated by these teams of overseas outsourced workers who we never see or hear from. And I don't think it's just conservatives who are concerned about that. You know, a lot of people on the left and more radical voices there have often raised the same critiques from an opposite perspective. And you can get into a debate of what is true, who's being more censored or who's not. But the fact is that we are all confronting this black box. And, you know, that gives a lot of power to these voices.
Adrian, you know, it seems to me obviously on the media side, which I cover even more than I do digital media, that there's a lot of what's called gaming the system, working the refs, and a desire to sort of preempt critical decisions that you might not want to have happen by claiming it reflects bias. I must say that in talking to people in Silicon Valley, I often find people fairly libertarian, which is to say against certain kinds of censorship and also really against government interaction and intervention. How much of what is done there is an attempt to forestall the government, you know, getting involved in their businesses and telling them the limits of what they can and can't do?
On behalf of the platforms,
yeah.
I think that is a big motivation, and Kate actually talks about this in her paper that that's always been a big motivation for self-regulation and for what they want to do is that they want to show themselves as responsible so that the government doesn't have to step in and sort of tell them what to do.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Jarvis, what do you think is the reasonable way for people to think about Facebook? Is it and Twitter and the others? Are these, you know, walled gardens or, you know, like Disneylands that it's wonderful to walk within, but you understand they set the rule? Or is this the new public square? Does this effectively become the place where we exchange information? A lot of news organizations have essentially turned over their comment sections to exchanges that they have on their Facebook accounts or on Twitter. You know, are these essentially public squares that we should treat and essentially try to enforce greater freedom of speech and First Amendment norms on?
I think the default of the platforms is toward freedom of speech, but again, you have bad actors trying to take advantage of that goodwill that we have. And so I think that they have a responsibility. You know, I hear journalists say in the same breath, Facebook has to go clean up this mess, but I don't trust Facebook to make judgments.
Yeah, I think that's
We've
about right.
We've got to figure that paradox out here, because what we are expecting them to do things. We're expecting them to deal with Russian manipulation. We're expecting them to do a lot of things. It is not the public. It is not the entirety of the internet. Mark Zuckerberg is not responsible for free speech in the world. The internet is that public square. The internet as a whole, but the various platforms on it, including, by the way, your show's own website and the New York Times' comments and letters to the editor of the Washington Post. Those are all controlled ways in which the public has a conversation, much more controlled than we have today.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing is, it seems to me that Facebook and Twitter succeed, particularly Facebook, if you compare them, and Google and YouTube, because they are so enormous, because they have such a high volume of users, and because they have a seemingly exponential growth in content that gets shared with it by those people that they don't have to by their users that they don't have to produce themselves. I can't imagine a world, even if they hired hundreds more people, where they could concretely address all the kind of legitimate concerns that are raised, even if they wanted to.
But here's the problem with what you just said, in my view, is that we in media see the world godlike in our image, and we see text on a screen, and we call that content. What you see on Facebook and Twitter is not content. It's a conversation. A democracy is indeed based around a conversation, and democracies and the conversations in them are messy. Part of what's going on right now is that we're hearing voices we never heard before, some of them angry, some of them inarticulate, some of them brilliant. And that noisiness, that cacophony, is democracy, but we're not used to it. And so what we're doing right now is negotiating our norms and standards. And society, a good portion of society, rose up and said, InfoWars is not acceptable in a civilized society. Boom. There we set a new rule. In this open world, it's going to be a long, long-term process. It's going to be messy, but so is democracy.
Adrian, what do you make of that?
Well, I think there's an issue with sort of the way you frame what's going on Facebook as a conversation, as if it's sort of natural and just unfolding, when it's really being structured at every point by how the choices that Facebook's designers have made by their commercial incentives to improve the amount of time we spend on site, by moderators who are looking at everything. And so I don't think that what is happening on Facebook is just a natural conversation. It's something that these people have designed and have oversee. And I think that the question of sort of what do we do about this, I'm always skeptical, like you, of these calls to clean up things, but I think for a different reason. And a lot of that comes from my reporting on sort of the ways that Facebook is moderated and the ways that they rely on this sort of underpaid contract labor that is extremely grueling and stressful, often outsourced to developing countries. You know, I've spoken with moderators who have been traumatized, who can't even look at their kids at night because of, you know, some of the child abuse images they've seen. And I think that a lot of the calls for increased moderation, for more oversight, is going to lead to this sort of ever-increasing army of underpaid, traumatized workers, or if you believe Facebook, this sort of new wave of artificial intelligence that will somehow, you know, govern everything. And I think we're just adding a whole nother layer and a whole nother level of complexity that in 5 years we'll be coming back and saying, what went wrong with all of these algorithms that are moderating everything? And so, yeah, I don't know. I guess the solution seeking is a little disturbing to me.
Jeff, let me give you briefly the last word on this.
Adrian, I think we agree that, and we're seeing going wrong right now in Europe. In Germany, there's a hate speech law that requires Facebook and other platforms to take down what they must judge as hate speech within 24 hours or face huge fines. Thus, that army of checkers you're talking about is going to play safe, and satire is going to die, and it's going to affect the conversation badly. Let me just leave you with this. Consider that Facebook is being put in position, and Twitter as well, but mainly Facebook, where Facebook's going to hire 20,000 people, they say, to check this stuff. In the United States right now, we have about 30,000 journalists working on daily newspapers. What does that say about our allocation of resources as a society? We are so concerned with the dystopia we're hearing about and the whack-a-mole against the bad guys, we're not putting enough resources into quality.
And that's Jeff Jarvis, author of the media blog BuzzMachine.com. He's journalism professor at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. Thanks for talking to us today. Adrian Chen is a journalist who covers technology and internet culture. Adrian, thanks for joining us here at On Point.
Thank you.
One of our listeners says Alex Jones isn't the problem. The millions of people who believe him are the problem, and that the remedy is more speech. But as Adrian Chen suggests, that speech may not be as free or as unsculpted as we think. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio, which has one of the hardest working teams in show business, produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Alex Schroeder, James Ross, Grace Tatter, and Kari Thompson. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.